From KCRW in Santa Monica and PRI, Public Radio International, this is To the Point.
Is America retreating from the world? I'm Leon Krause, in for Warren Olney, and this is To the Point. During the Obama administration, numerous voices from the Republican Party criticized Obama for leading from behind. But as president, Donald Trump has made the withdrawal from international commitments his calling card. Is America now leading through retreat and isolation? What will the global stage look like with a diminished United States? Who will fill the void? Europe, China, or Russia? And later, on today's talking point, they played a significant role in Donald Trump's anti-immigrant agenda, but now they say they feel exploited. Family members of people killed by undocumented immigrants. But first, here's the news.
Check out KCRW's all-news channel, News 24. Programming from KCRW, NPR, BBC, and more. 24 hours a day. Go to kcrw.com/news24 or listen on KCRW's app.
Support for To the Point comes from the members of KCRW and from the Public Radio International Program Fund.
I'm Leon Krause, in for Warren Olney, and this is To the Point. Is President Trump taking his America First agenda to extremes, withdrawing the country from the international stage on trade and climate change, distancing America from its traditional allies across the Atlantic, and even threatening to physically isolate the country through the building of a wall along its southern border? That's our main topic today. On today's talking point, family members of people killed by undocumented immigrants played a significant role in Donald Trump's presidential campaign. But now, some say they were taken advantage of by a nonprofit group and by the president himself. First, this news out of Moscow. In a reversal, Russian President Vladimir Putin conceded today in Moscow that Russian hackers might have meddled in the American election. Mr. Putin did not, however, admit any government involvement, referring instead to what he called patriotically minded private Russian hackers. They are like artists, Putin said. David Filipov, Moscow bureau chief for the Washington Post, joins us. David, thank you for being with us. These are dangerous artists we're talking about.
Yeah, it's an artist who gets up in the morning, decides to paint a picture, and the next thing you know, your private emails and your credit card number is in the public domain.
What exactly did Putin say? Because we just shared a bit of the quote. It was much more florid than that.
Yeah, hackers are free people, just like artists. Wake up in the morning in a good mood and start painting. And then, you know, the next thing you know, your dialysis machine doesn't work. But he didn't say that. That's me adding on.
But he could have.
He said, if they are patriotically minded, they start making their contributions, which are right from their point of view, to fight against those who say bad things about Russia. So, you know, who is Vladimir Putin anyway? He is positing himself as the lucid, reasonable-minded counter to the other leader of the world, Donald Trump, right now. He's sounding like a regular guy. Hey, you know, maybe the hackers are Russian. He also said today that, you know, it could be Americans faking to be Russians because you can do that on the Internet. So he's just saying a lot of things that kind of confuse us and make us wonder what he's up to, which is his game.
Now, like you're saying, there are no coincidences when it comes to Putin. Why now? What is he trying to achieve?
Well, again, the whole point of the Internet hacking campaign, all of the propaganda campaign, if there was a point at all, it was try to make the United States and its democracy look chaotic, look ridiculous, not legitimate, and sort of, hey, we're Russia over here. We're reasonable. We believe in legitimate governments. We don't go exporting our system like the United States does. And besides, look at them. They're a mess. They look ridiculous, whereas we're here just doing our business. That's the whole game behind all of this stuff that's been happening since those emails were first hacked. And so Putin shrugging his shoulders and saying, hey, you know, I don't know who did it. It wasn't me. Maybe it was hackers. Maybe it was patriots. That's just more of that, hey, I'm a reasonable guy here. You keep accusing me. It's not me. I'm just trying to help you out here. Meanwhile, you know, President Trump is tweeting away and the investigation is in Congress and everyone's screaming over there about Russian involvement. He smirks. He looks rational. And, you know, the United States looks like a clown show.
Now, Putin has different audiences. What he says is interpreted very differently inside Russia and abroad. How will this statement play out domestically? The idea of Russian patriotism is crucial in Russia, has always been crucial.
Well, of course, Putin's high rating, which is always above 80%, has been since Crimea, last, you know, 3 years. His rating is in large part, according to pollsters I've spoken to, because of the way he has made Russians feel, hey, everybody might not like us, they may fear us, they may blame us for everything, but they have to take us seriously as a great power. You know, it's this kind of these colors don't run attitude that sweeps up ordinary people, even if they don't feel like their lives are getting better as a result. At least they know, hey, I'm Russian, and the world has to recognize Russia. So when Putin says, hey, it wasn't us, you guys are, you know, accusing us, but it wasn't us, you know, it rings with, you know, that whole idea. Why are they all attacking Russia? Why are they all blaming us? Well, you know, we got Putin there defending us. That's kind of the way it comes off. And it's not much different from the way that, you know, people see it outside Russia, except that outside Russia, we're asking the questions you and me are talking about, which is, what is that guy up to? What's he trying to do? He denied it for all these months, and now he's saying maybe Russians did it. And it's part of the game here. It is, we're rational Russia.
Yes.
You guys are afraid of us. You blame us for everything, but we make sense, and you don't.
Now, Putin has been curiously active these last few days, including an uncomfortable visit with French President Macron. How did that play out?
Well, again, you know, a lot of attention was paid to the handshakes and the body languages. But again, you have to understand that Putin gladly and openly hosted Marine Le Pen.
Yes.
And made no secret of that. And then, you know, he marched right into Paris and went right up to Macron. Macron stood his ground. Putin said the same thing. We didn't interfere here. Why do you keep saying this? It's ridiculous. To Russians, it's Putin again representing our interests, standing up for us. We're not going to let some French guy, you know, tell us what to think. We got Putin there. I mean, whether or not people are happy, and there's a lot of people who are unhappy in Russia, and whether or not their lives are getting better, on the end where Putin sits, they feel satisfied that he's looking after their interests.
We will talk more about Macron and Europe in the following segments. Thank you for joining us, David. A pleasure to talk to you. That was David Filipov, Moscow Bureau Chief for The Washington Post. In a moment, is America retreating from the world? On To The Point from PRI.
KCRW thanks Factiva from Dow Jones for its use of Factiva.com.
I'm Leon Krause, in for Warren Olney, back with To The Point. Observers of the Trump White House noticed two opposing groups of advisers surrounding the president, the globalists and the nationalists. The former promotes conservative values while advocating for America's continued presence and influence on world affairs, while the latter appears to encourage the president to withdraw the country from the global stage on a series of issues from trade to global warming, following Trump's America First campaign pledge. Is this dangerous isolationism a domestic political play or a sensible path forward? Jeremy Cliff, political editor and columnist at The Economist, joins us from Berlin. Good to have you with us, Jeremy. Trump's meeting with European leaders has presented a diplomatic challenge for pro-American Europeans. How was Trump's trip to Europe interpreted there? Was it an incredible and historic visit, as Press Secretary Spicer said it was?
It didn't go down very well, I'm afraid. Everything from the optics So the tone that Mr. Trump used, the way he dealt with his European counterparts, to the announcements that he made, to the language that he used, to the way he talked about, for example, NATO and the contributions that he expects other NATO members to start making. I mean, the arguments that he made were not themselves completely new. I mean, Washington has been saying that Europe should contribute more to NATO for a long time. It was the way he said it. So, for example, in Brussels, he didn't mention the mutual defense clause, the famous Article 5 of NATO. He berated European leaders in front of the cameras. It wasn't a very diplomatic way of putting across a message that is in itself relatively reasonable.
From the perspective of European leaders, is the United States in fact retreating from the global stage?
That's certainly how it's seen here. And I mean, this has become clear over the last few days in some of the statements that have come from Angela Merkel here in Germany. On Sunday, she was speaking to a crowd of voters in Munich and said that the times in which Europe could rely on others are to some extent over, as I've experienced in the last 2 days. This is a very, very clear reference to Trump's behavior during his European trip. And she went on to say, we Europeans must take our fate into our own hands, to a huge applause. And I think that just illustrates the sense that the Atlantic is getting wider. Now, you know, you talk to establishment figures here in Berlin, and they acknowledge what you call the globalist aspect of Washington, the sort of Washington establishment. They recognize that plenty of people in senior positions in Washington, in the American establishment, are still very firmly committed to NATO, want a close relationship with Europe. But at the same time, there is this sense that you can't be sure where America's going, and it's under its current leadership, it's in an unpredictable place. So there is definitely a sense that Europe can't look to America for leadership in the way that it could in the past.
They prepared thoroughly for Trump's visit, European leaders. They must have known he would be an America First president. Did they take that into account and try to basically bend over backwards to accommodate Trump's interest and his agenda? And are they now disappointed that they couldn't break through to the president?
There have definitely been efforts to engage with him, and you see this. This is an ongoing, albeit less widely covered aspect of Germany's reaction to his election last November. Angela Merkel has, behind the scenes in particular, worked hard to try and persuade him that Germany, for example, is not manipulating the currency to sell more cars to America, which is an accusation that he repeatedly levels at Germany. When she went over to Washington in March, she brought a lot of German executives and also German apprentices to try and sort of educate the president about the German economic system and to emphasize the amount of investment that German firms put into the American economy. So there is an ongoing attempt, I think, to change the way he sees Europe and to sort of to back him down from some of his more aggressive positions. However, there's an election here in Germany in September.
Yes.
There are also legislative elections in France this month. And it's become very tempting, I think, for European politicians to bash Mr. Trump, to bash America, to win some easy electoral points here in Europe. Mr. Trump has, I'm afraid, made it a lot easier for anti-American sentiment, or has made it more tempting for European leaders to flirt with anti-American sentiment.
Are the upcoming elections how you would explain Angela Merkel's unusual language following the meeting with Trump, and even Emmanuel Macron's interactions with the president and with Vladimir Putin himself a few days afterwards?
Absolutely. Two past elections haunt Angela Merkel, those in 2002 and 2005, when the Social Democratic Chancellor, Gerhard Schröder, so her opponent, won over voters by posing as the anti-George W. Bush candidate. He was quite willing to put a lot of distance between his Germany and America, and it won him a lot of support. And I think she's very aware that that could be a dynamic in this election too. Martin Schulz, who is the SPD, the centre-left candidate to replace her, is very, very vocally anti-Trump. He called the president a destroyer of Western values. Mr. Schulz is against Germany meeting its 2% of GDP target for defense spending. So Schulz has been trying to make political capital out of Mr. Trump. And so I think Merkel's statement on Sunday was her way of trying to cover off that and prevent that from becoming a major dividing line in this election. She is fundamentally and temperamentally an Atlanticist. You know, only on Thursday she had what could only be be described as a sort of public love-in with Barack Obama at a church festival here in Berlin.
Yes.
So she's absolutely pro-American, but I think she recognizes that there is an anti-American streak in the German electorate, and that Trump is very distasteful to a lot of German voters. So she has to compromise a bit with that aspect of German, sort of the German outlook on America.
Let us bring into a conversation Jeet Heer, who's a senior editor at the New Republic. Jeet, thank you for joining us. You've said that this moment, this great American retreat, if you will, is indeed a watershed moment, not limited to Trump, but also a systemic shift in American foreign policy, specifically when you think of the Republican Party. Jeet, how so?
Well, I think we should be very careful not to personalize things in Trump, that he was selected by the party through a primary system and he won the election because he was able to rally the Republican voters around him. And after the election, he's constantly received support from Republican office holders in Congress and the Senate, who have the constitutional ability to check him on foreign policy and other matters if they don't. So if you're European and you're looking at what Trump is doing, you're not just going to say, well, you know, I don't like this man. It's like, this man is the president, and he has his party behind him. And I think that there's a further aspect, which is that Trump's unilateralism is not unique to him. I think that since the sort of beginning of the Cold War and the founding of NATO, there's always been a tension in the United States between a kind of internationalism that sees America as the guarantor of global capitalism and trade and liberalism, and a sort of nationalism that wants to put American interests first. We saw that with sort of Nixon, with the way he took America off the gold standard. We saw that with George W. Bush, with the derision towards old Europe and the creation of the Coalition of the Willing, the sort of contempt for the UN. So there's a kind of unilateralist tradition which Trump is very much part of. And I think that in the long sweep of history, we can kind of see that the sort of the cracks in the Western alliance really opened up with Bush and Cheney.
Mm-hmm.
And then Barack Obama gave the sort of the Atlantic alliance a second life because he was very much welcomed by the Europeans and he emphasized multilateralism. But now with Trump, we have not just Bush, but Bush kind of squared, Bush taken to the absurd degree. And so if you're European, you're going to think, well, we gave America a second chance. Are we going to give them a third chance?
Mm-hmm. David French, who's a senior writer at the National Review, is also with us. David, do you agree with Jeet Heer, who's a senior editor at the New Republic? Is it an exaggeration to think of a, let's say, great American retreat from the global stage? Are we overreacting? Is this part of a systemic change? What's your take?
You know, I'll think there's a great American retreat if the 2nd Cavalry Regiment leaves Germany or if the 173rd Airborne Brigade Combat Team leaves Italy. If we start seeing an actual change in American forward deployments overseas, if we see actual changes in real-world events, I'll believe it much more. Right now, I think what we have is this curious situation where you have a president of the United States who, frankly, in his public pronouncements, is just all over the place. One minute he's calling NATO obsolete. Another minute he's reaffirming commitment to NATO. He's saying he's going to leave NAFTA. Then he's going to stay in NAFTA. He's going to move the embassy out of from Tel Aviv, the American embassy from Tel Aviv to Jerusalem. Then he's not going to do it. So you have all of that going on, which creates this inherent instability. And then you have a professional class of people that he's hired, like General Mattis, the Secretary of Defense, who's running around working to reassure allies, working to double down on American security commitments. I mean, we just had a accelerated deployment of anti-missile defenses in South Korea, which was a promising development. So again, the difficulty in interpreting all of this is normally a president's policy pronouncements are in line with real-world events. What you have now with the current president is the policy pronouncements, to the extent they're even policy pronouncements, strike me more as impulses than impulsive utterances than anything else.
Mm-hmm.
And so I'm very curious. I'm mainly curious to see what are the real world actions that are taken not so much the latest tweet or the latest utterance.
Jeremy Cliff, political editor and columnist at The Economist, do you agree with David French? Do you think reality will in the end prevail? Are these just political statements? And I would like to hear your opinion, but also if you could share with us what European figures, political figures, think of this. You recently interviewed, for example, former German Foreign Minister Wolfgang Ischinger. What was his view on all this?
Actually, I do agree with that. I think there's a real gulf between the transatlantic alliance as experienced through on Twitter and on the front pages of newspapers and in election campaigns. And I think that's getting very sensationalist and emotional. And then there is this whole other aspect of the alliance which lives on very, very closely, the military relationship. NATO is still the security umbrella that keeps Europe safe and guarantees its freedom and prosperity. So there is this divide between the politics and the theatrics on the one side and the kind of the military reality on the other. And I think what people like, for example, former Ambassador Ischinger and other Atlanticists here in Europe want to see is, well, first of all, they stress that the president and his own unpredictable style is not illustrative of Washington in general and even some members of his own team. So he name-checked the likes of John Kelly, the Homeland Security Secretary, CIA Director Pompeo, other prominent figures, and said they're really good and they're experienced and they are reassuring. And Europe should work particularly with people like that who are perhaps more reliable partners than the president mm-hmm. himself. I think that the risk, though, is that that first aspect of the relationship, so this kind of the political aspect of it, the electoral aspect of it, starts to affect the second more substantive aspect of it. And you see one example of that here. We had the Chinese Premier Li Keqiang was in Berlin today visiting Merkel, and they unveiled a whole range of new ways in which they're going to be working together. And I think the risk mm-hmm. is that if Trump raises the costs of continuing to work with America closely for European leaders, they will turn away, and the substance of the transatlantic relationship will itself start to suffer.
Jeet here, talking about actions, Trump did leave the TPP. Trump will apparently leave the Paris Agreement. So is Trump all talk and no action?
Yeah, I want to reject this notion that Trump is just theatrics and Twitter, and that there's a substance that will survive. I mean, we are, after all, talking about the president of the United States. Those policies that you mentioned, will have real world substantial effects. And I would also add that I think just having an erratic president itself is a substantial issue. That if you're a European, your freedom and your very life depends on this sort of nuclear umbrella. And if you have, a figure that is like as unstable as Trump, that, changes his mind so quickly, you're going to be thinking very hard about, is this what I want in the future? That the American electorate will, put a buffoon in office and that figure will be in charge of whether I remain free or not. I think the idea that this is just theatrics really ignores the real power that the American president has, and also the very way in which erratic behavior undermines policy.
David French, I know that you will like to respond, but I would like to add, are you at all concerned that Trump's foreign policy will create an opening for greater Chinese and maybe even Russian influence on the world stage, like Jeremy Cliff was saying a couple of minutes ago?
Oh, I'm absolutely concerned. And I think that I don't think that anybody who seriously looks at what Trump says that his erratic statements don't matter. I think the question is, how much do they matter? And here's where I think that his erratic statements and impulsiveness really introduce a problem, a deeply problematic element to foreign affairs. And that is, when you don't align your actions and your words, and when your words give people the impression that your actions are going to be different from what they are, you introduce an element of ambiguity and lack of clarity and confusion
Yes.
that history teaches us can be extremely volatile. And that's what I'm very concerned about.
That's David French. Hold that thought. We're going to take a brief break and continue the conversation. Later on today's Talking Point, family members of people killed by undocumented immigrants figured prominently during Trump's presidential campaign, but now they say they have been exploited. We'll find out why. This is To The Point from PRI. I'm Leon Krause, in for Warren Olney, and this is To The Point. As we go to air, we're still waiting for the reality show-like announcement in the White House as to whether President Trump is officially withdrawing the United States from the Paris Climate Agreement. But Europeans and others are not holding their breath. They are already preparing for a world with a diminished American presence. Andrew Steer is president and CEO of the World Resources Institute. That's an environmental think tank. And he joins us to talk about the Paris Accord, a far-reaching commitment that currently includes 194 other nations and the United States as well. Only Nicaragua and Syria have declined to join in the past. Andrew, would it be a mistake for the United States to leave the Paris Accord? Thank you for being with us.
Well, 1,000 American corporations think it would be. They have all pleaded with President Trump over the last couple of weeks to stay in. And yes, I believe that there are several reasons why it is a mistake for Mr. Trump to pull out, one of which is this role in the world that we're talking about on this program. I mean, the United States is the indispensable leader in so many areas, and it has been over many decades, and it's a great shame that that is being given up. But I think there are economic and other reasons. I think the United States economically would be much better staying in. We and many others have done a lot of analysis. Last week, the OECD came out with a report that showed convincingly that smart policies on climate change actually promote better resource efficiency, better technology, more consistency of policies, and therefore more investment, more technology, more competitiveness, and so on. And so Mr. Trump has had some very bad economic advice based upon last century's economics. But if you do use today's economics, it's a big loss. But I think, you know, things will continue. The good news is that the United States has a remarkable constitution that gives a lot of authority to states and municipalities. And also, for the first time, just in the last month, we've seen the United States corporate sector stand up in a way they never have before. It's always been the European CEOs of corporations have said, for goodness sake, you know, we see the writing on the wall. The government needs to align towards a clean future. And the United States, that hasn't been the case, but it is now the case in quite a significant way.
Let me run you, Andrew Steer, through a couple of common arguments against the Paris Agreement that I've heard lately. China, the world's biggest greenhouse gas emitter, is not doing enough, people say, to fight climate change. In Trumpian terms, China has the better deal. Is this true?
Well, the very week that Mr. Trump announced he was going to eviscerate America's climate policies, China announced another $360 billion for clean energy. This year, China will be putting in place a nationwide cap and trade system. The United States investing clean energy less than half of what China does. Last year, China invested $32 billion in other countries on renewable energy. Coal consumption in China has been falling for the last 4 years. So anybody who looks at the facts and says that China is not doing much, I mean, it is just living in cuckoo land. China is taking this very seriously, partly because they're very concerned about climate change, but more importantly, they see this as very smart for their economics, just like Prime Minister Modi. Prime Minister Modi came into power with a non-environmental message, a message, I want India to grow. Mm-hmm. He had three gigawatts of solar power. He said, I'm going to have 100 gigawatts by 2022. I'm going to create a new industry. I'm going to bring technology in. I need disruptive change. And he's doing exactly that. He is he understands today's economics, which is all about dynamic responsiveness of the private sector to constant long-term signals, much better than the current administration in the United States.
David French, a senior writer at the National Review, I know that you think that the Paris Agreement is not beneficial for American workers. Could you explain why?
Well, there's a couple of objections I have. One is just flatly constitutional. If you're going to enter into an international agreement that purports to bind American actions across multiple administrations, you do that through a treaty process. And the reason why you do that is the treaty process itself, not only is it constitutionally mandated, but it's also something that in the wisdom of the drafters of the Constitution, you're creating a mechanism for creating and negotiating agreements that will reach American consensus. And when you have American consensus, you have enduring agreements. And that's not done here, and that creates an ongoing political problem. The second thing is this is kind of a movie we've seen before. The Kyoto, the previous climate accords, really in many ways collapsed because the targets were unrealistic. They were more costly than anticipated, and that kind of top-down governmental-driven economic change is problematic in its own right. I'm fully confident in the capability of the American private sector to innovate and to develop new technologies.
Yes.
That, you know, if it's an economic no-brainer to do this, it's an economic no-brainer. And in those private corporations, this private sector is more than capable of innovating without violating the Constitution by entering into an agreement like this.
Now the agreement is non-binding precisely because the American Senate, which was controlled by the Republican Party, was never going to sign such an ambitious climate change treaty. Is this a fair assessment, you think?
Well, I think it's fair that the treaty as originally envisioned likely wouldn't be ratified. However, it's the job of a president of the United States, if it is a matter of such dramatic import to the future, not just of the United States, but to the planet itself, to negotiate an agreement and sell it to the American people in such a manner that their elective representatives will agree to it. But that wasn't done here. It would seem to never even really be the intent. And so thus we're left with a voluntary, non-binding agreement that any nation can really depart from, much the way they've departed from previous climate accords, when it's in their economic national self-interest. So, as I said, we've seen this movie before. Nations act in their perceived economic self-interest. They'll continue to do that. And this accord won't change that.
This is David French, senior writer at the National Review. Jit here. Let me ask you, could Obama do it? I mean, realistically, could Obama have done it, a push for a treaty instead of just signing the Paris Agreement? Do you agree with David French?
Well, he couldn't have done it, and I think it's actually important to emphasize why not. And this goes to the issue of why the problem is not just Trump, but the Republican Party. The Republican Party's position on climate is very radical. It denies that climate change is a problem. And this is a position not taken by any other major party in the entire planet, as far as I'm known. That there's, like, you know, you have vast diversity of politics in the world. The Republican Party is the climate denying party, and because of the American Constitution, they have a veto power over this. So I think that, but this really speaks to the heart of what we're talking about, that the positions taken by Trump and the Republican Party are putting America in isolation from the rest of the world. And on this issue, which is the most important issue humanity has ever faced.
Andrew Steer, President and CEO of the World Resources Institute, is the Republican Party indeed the climate denial party in the world?
Well, we're not aware of any other country that has a major political party with this position. No, and it's going to be changing. There's no question about that. The only issue is precisely when. Look, whether this should have been ratified, the whole point, as you and Jit have said, is that actually it is a voluntary agreement in terms of targets, and therefore, along with about 80% of other sort of analogous international agreements, this is decided by the executive rather than by Congress. Indeed, other countries also wouldn't have been particularly keen to have made this an international treaty. This, in many ways, is a fairly modern. I mean, we've learned a lot about sort of nudging. Solutions come not by sort of textbook, approaches where if you don't do what you promised to do, you get sent to prison. Change really comes about as peers get together. They learn how to do things. They realize it's in their economic and political interest. And we are in a very different way, where I really do agree with David, we're in a very different position to where we were 15 years ago. 15 years ago, addressing climate change really did have trade-offs. There really were costs. Since then, the price of renewable energy, for example, has fallen by 80%, and the price of many other technologies has fallen as well. So we're now at that tipping point. Now, what David says is, well, if we're at a tipping point, the private sector will go ahead anyway, so they don't need the government. Yeah, but every single CEO will say, look, we need long-term sort of constant clarity as to what direction we're going in the policy environment from the government. And every other government is pointing in that way. And that's why tomorrow China and the European Union are going to announce a major new initiative, common approaches on technologies, on energy efficiency, renewable energy, transport, cities, technology cooperation, even direct investment in each other's countries, cooperation in developing countries together. They're not sitting still. They're getting on with it.
Before we let David French respond, because I know he wants to, Jeremy Cliff, political editor and columnist at The Economist, let me ask you, how is this matter seen in Europe? Is this another opening for China, like Andrew was just describing? What can you tell us?
Well, I think this is just another example of how, to go back to what we were discussing earlier, the theatrics of Donald Trump, you know, the impulsiveness, the sort of emotional volatility, the tweets sent in the early hours of the morning, how that translates into real-life substance. And to Jeet's earlier point, for clarification, I absolutely do think that those theatrics translate into real substance. And this is a really good example. You know, I think... You know, Trump's worldview is very zero sum. It's a world of absolute winners and absolute losers. You know, it's a worldview forged, I suppose, by his business career, when it really is about, you know, one guy wins and the other guy loses. And I think the danger is, and you see this with his stance on the environment, is that he risks not only applying this this zero sum worldview to international diplomacy, America's international commitments and responsibilities in a way that's not at all appropriate, but also that he sort of exports that logic to other countries. And I guess the concern that I have is that you end up getting a sort of tit-for-tat retaliatory sort of diplomacy arising between America and other countries like the Europeans, like the Chinese. And just to give you one example, you ask about what it means for how America is seen for the politics of the transatlantic relationship here in Germany. Well, Martin Schulz, who I mentioned earlier, the center-left rival to Angela Merkel, he seized this opportunity of Trump's wavering over Paris, and said that if America pulls out, then Germany and Europe should retaliate. That was the phrase he used, retaliate, cutting trade links, imposing new barriers on American goods that are produced under different environmental standards from those that apply in Europe. And my concern, I suppose, is that what starts as a very sort of emotional response from the man in the White House ripples across the world and actually starts to influence the way that other world leaders and other political systems think about these challenges.
And that's Jeremy Cliff, political editor and columnist at The Economist. David French, a senior writer at The National Review. I want to ask you about those ripples, that ripple effect, but I want to add something to the conversation. According to a Department of Energy report just published in January, the solar industry employs close to 375,000 Americans versus the 160,000 who work for the coal industry. So my question, David, would be this. Would it be fair to say that this is more a political than a labor-related issue at the moment?
Well, you know, that's an interesting statistic, but one that doesn't illuminate that coal is still a more efficient energy producer. There's a lot more people employed to produce less energy out of solar. But I think that, you know, one of the key aspects here, and I just have to object to the sort of the blanket characterization of the Republican Party as in sort of in this climate science denial mode. I think there are people in the Republican Party who certainly say that there's no link between human activity and the climate. I think that's a small minority, certainly, of Republican politicians that think the actual question is, what is it that we can do? What are the things that the United States can do or will do, and at what cost, and at what impact will they have on the environment? So, for example, how many jobs are you willing to lose, for example, to have a negligible impact on the environment, 0.01 degree or some such? And that's a very viable and live debate, and one worth having. It isn't simply the case that you say, well, climate change is real, climate change is dangerous, therefore, whatever the international community suggests, we're going to do. No, I think there's got to be an American domestic political process, and this is one that's been laid out in our Constitution, and it's a treaty process. And if we want to do a long-standing, multinational, commitment-based approach to tackling this issue, that's the approach to take. Now, I would say, I'll say this, I'm far from being a isolationist or protectionist in any way, shape, or form, and have disagreed with Trump vigorously on those elements of his platform when he advances them. And I do agree that there are many circumstances where his words translate into action and into negative action on the international stage. I think this one, if he does withdraw from the Paris Climate Accords,
yes,
is one where he's acting in furtherance of his constitutional duties.
But by the way, we are just learning now that the Associated Press and other sources are now reporting that, that the Trump administration will indeed withdraw from the Paris Accord. With that context, Andrew Steer, let me ask you, is the global goal of limiting global warming to below 2 degrees Celsius attainable without America's active participation?
Yes, it is attainable, but with much more difficulty. We were actually starting to accelerate rather well, and the U.S. was playing a very valuable leadership role. We at the World Resource Institute look around the world at the other countries as well. We've formed a coalition of 55 high-ambition countries, and we're seeing no willingness to pull back at all. It can be done, and of course this hopefully is just a four-year pulling out of the global engagement. And in the meantime, the United States will continue to play a role at the subnational level. I mean, we're seeing that in all around the United States at the moment in terms of utilities being forced to provide more renewable energy because their big clients are demanding it and because financial markets are demanding it. And so we are still going to see that. It's not a lost game, but mm-hmm. clearly, it's going to be other countries in the lead. And this has a very, very sad day for the United States, and it's a very, very sad day for the global environment.
Can it be reversed in the future with a different president? How would that work, Andrew?
Oh, well, look, I mean, legally, I don't know what he's precisely going to announce, but if he says he's pulling out of the Paris deal, he can't begin to do that legally for another 3 years, and then it takes about a year to get out. So he would actually be leaving legally. Now, substantively, he can basically pull out tomorrow. He can just not pay any attention to it, not send Americans to the discussions and so on. But legally, he would just have pulled out just mm-hmm. before he leaves office. And a future American president will be warmly welcomed. Of course, by then things will have moved on, so the United States will be expected to have a higher ambition. One of the interesting things today to look for from the president is,
yes,
does he have any policy whatsoever on climate change? So far, he has none. In other words, the federal government of the biggest country in the world in terms of the economy has no policy on climate change. Luckily, 30 states have very clear policies. They have renewable energy standards and so on.
Yes.
Luckily, 500 cities have policies. Luckily, 1,000 companies have policies. But the federal government has none. It'd be very interesting to see, does he have anything whatsoever to say on climate change? If
yes.
the answer is no, this is a massive, massive failure for this government and for this planet.
And we will soon find out whether that's the case. I want to thank Jeremy Cliff, Jit Heer, David French, and Andrew Steer for joining with us. Thank you for joining us. Thank you, gentlemen. And next on our talking point, Donald Trump told their stories on the campaign trail. But now, family members of Americans killed by undocumented immigrants say they feel abused and exploited. Stay with us. This is To The Point from PRI. Leon Krause here with today's talking point. Donald Trump's anti-immigrant agenda played a central role in his presidential campaign, as we all know. He often relied on family members of people killed by undocumented immigrants who spoke on his behalf at rallies and the Republican convention itself. One of them was Brenda Sparks.
My son is named Eric Zepeda. He was raised by a legal immigrant from Honduras, only to be murdered by an illegal in 2011. His murderer never did a second in handcuffs or jail. Got away with killing an American. So I'm voting for Trump. And by the way, so is my mother.
Now Ms. Sparks and others are speaking out against Donald Trump. Kenneth Vogel, chief investigative reporter at Politico, has the story. Ken, good to have you with us.
Great to be with you.
So what is the nature of these complaints? It's a complex piece that you've written. Why don't you give us the explanation of this behind these complaints?
Yeah, sure. Some of these families are, in fact, upset with Trump. They feel like they were used and sort of exploited as political props by him, and that he, made big promises about what he was going to do on immigration. And they are upset that he hasn't gone far enough, that he reversed his decision to get rid of DACA, the Deferred Action for Childhood Arrivals, and that he has not been as aggressive as they would like with building the border wall. But really, their main beef is with this nonprofit group called the Remembrance Project that arranged for Donald Trump to for these families to speak at Trump rallies and to appear during his the speech in Arizona, at which he laid out his hardline immigration policies, and even to appear in his television ads during the campaign, his campaign ads, and at the Republican convention. They say that this group and the woman who was the head of it used them, and to a lesser extent, Trump used them to further their own respective political ends, and that they have not delivered on promises, in Trump's case, to enact a hardline anti-immigrant agenda.
This project, the Remembrance Project, run by a woman named Maria Espinosa, right?
That's right, Maria Espinosa. She calls herself a fifth-generation Texan on her mom's side, but says that her dad was an immigrant who arrived in the country from Mexico legally. And she has long been pushing this cause of illegal immigrant crime, suggesting that this is a bigger problem than perhaps the statistics show that it is. But it was something that really took off in 2013 when Democrats and some Republicans, the Gang of Eight, push for a comprehensive immigration reform that included a pathway to citizenship. Suddenly, these Republican politicians who opposed comprehensive immigration reform saw the utility and the rhetorical power in having these families be able to testify, in some cases literally in Capitol Hill hearings, in other cases just in press conferences, to say, here's why undocumented immigrants are so bad because of what they did to our families. Trump seized on that, seized on these families, took the rhetoric to the next level, and you said in the intro, it's arguable that it was the key animating issue of his campaign and what really set him apart from the rest of the Republican field. These families were a big part of that because they provided the human face, and now they're feeling more than a little bit exploited.
It certainly was during the Republican convention. Now, family members have asked for money that was raised, but have they received any? Money will go for legal and medical bills. Have they received any money?
They have not received any money from the group, from the Remembrance Project, and they believe that the Remembrance Project promised them that some of this money that was raised, a lot of which was raised during the campaign when the group's profile was elevated by Donald Trump, who came and spoke at their first annual, what they hope to be their first annual conference down in Houston, which was just about 2 months before the election, and they raised a bunch of money, and this money has all gone back into the organization. Maria Espinosa says that the purpose of raising this money in the organization is merely to elevate this issue and to prompt action on this issue at a federal level, not to provide direct compensation or reimbursement for these families who have, you know, in some cases, quite a bit of cost accumulated as a result of their tragedies, medical costs, burial costs, legal costs, et cetera. Nonetheless, they thought that this group would provide them that. And then additionally, what this group pushed for was this office that Trump did, in fact, establish within the Department of Homeland Security.
Voice, right? Victims of Immigrant Crime Engagement. Is that office not enough for these families?
Well, that office does not actually carry with it any funding, any direct assistance to these families.
It was just politics.
Right. Well, I mean, that's certainly the charge. And that is, when I put that to Maria Espinosa saying, well, are you satisfied with what Trump has done on this voice office? She blamed Congress. She said, well, it's Congress. It's Congress's fault that Trump hasn't been able to build the wall. It's Congress's fault that there hasn't been more funding allocated to this program, this voice program, to be able to help these folks directly. That's not a super satisfying set of explanations for these families who, again, feel like to some extent they were sold a bill of goods, even though many, I should say, many continue to believe in Trump and believe that his goals were, in fact, consistent with theirs and were genuine, but that he was sort of sold a bill of goods by this group, was used by this group, and has not been able to deliver on some of the promises in the way that they had hoped that he would.
Now, there's clearly an underlying issue to all this, which is immigrant crime, undocumented immigrant crime. What are the real statistics? What are the statistics on undocumented immigrant crime in America?
Yeah, I mean, we looked at some of this stuff.
Aside from these individual particular tragedies that obviously these families went through that are
right.
So terrible.
Yeah, I mean, there's not a whole lot of evidence that there's any disproportionate, criminal activity by undocumented immigrants. And that's sort of what makes these family stories so important. You can put up all the statistics that you want, but you put up one grieving mother whose child was killed by an undocumented immigrant, and that's pretty powerful stuff. Trump realized that intuitively. I mean, let's not forget if you recall, when he made his announcement speech and said that Mexicans coming to the country are rapists and they're bringing drugs, and then added almost as an afterthought, and I assume some are good people, that was really almost unanimously condemned across the political spectrum. It wasn't 3 weeks later that Trump was appearing with these families at a press conference
in Los Angeles.
Los Angeles. Correct. And that, again, is a pretty, you could quibble with the statistics, but you can't quibble with the sort of impact of that image. Trump knew that this was good for him, good for his campaign, and it was.
Lastly, Ken, any response from the White House?
The White House has not commented. We do understand that Maria Espinosa does continue to be in touch with both the White House and with Jeff Sessions at the Department of Justice and John Kelly at the Department of Homeland Security. They're not going away. In fact, we understand they are growing. They've opened an office in D.C. They've created a new nonprofit group, the Remembrance Project Advocacy, which will allow them to directly support candidates.
Yes.
It's a powerful collaboration between them and Trump.
And Ms. Espinosa apparently is planning to run for Congress, so this story will keep on growing. Ken, thank you so much for being with us.
It was a pleasure to be with you.
Thank you to Ken Vogel and to all our guests. This is Leon Krause in for Warren Olney. To the Point is a co-production of KCRW Santa Monica and Public Radio International.
PRI, Public Radio International.